This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 6:37 on the evening edition with Kelvin and Hezril. Next up, we're looking at what it's like being diagnosed with, treated, and subsequently recovering from COVID-19. So there was a piece written by patient number 33 in the Malay Mail about what their experience was like. The article essentially highlighted the dedication of Malaysia's medical and healthcare workers in Sungai Buloh Hospital.
That's right, and it gave good insights into what it's like being a patient and how the healthcare system treats you. And not just this piece alone, right? Other articles patients have written share how the healthcare system is great and how frontline health workers are doing their very best.
Yeah, personally, you know, for me, it does help calm some of my nerves about what happens if you do contract COVID-19. You know, for I have some amount of anxiety about the whole process, and reading these have been quite helpful. So back to patient 33, the Edge recently interviewed him and confirmed that the patient in question is actually lawyer Rosli Dahlan, who we do have on the line. Rosli Dahlan is, of course, a lawyer who recently recovered from COVID-19. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. Let's start from the beginning. Take us through the timeline of your diagnosis and quarantine. What were your first symptoms and how did that progress to hospitalization?
I had a board meeting, an UDA board meeting, on the 24th. And basically, after that, or the next day, because I was traveling as well a bit within the country, I developed a bit of a flu, a runny nose. I went to the clinic, the neighborhood clinic, and first question I asked is, do I have to worry anything about COVID? The doctor looked at it and the symptoms and said, no, nothing to worry about. Give me some medicine and said, you know, in the next few days, if you don't feel well, you just come back. That was the 25th. On the 29th, which was a Saturday, I went back to the clinic. And this time around, I said, I've developed some fever and it's quite painful, the fever. Again, the doctor said that maybe let's check for dengue, did a blood test and so on, and told me, look, nothing to worry about COVID also. Because by then, I came to the clinic with my wife who had symptoms of a fever. She didn't have a flu, but she had a fever. I had a bit of a runny nose, but the doctor said there's nothing. So I felt quite okay. That was Saturday. On the 1st of March, sometime around 10, 11 o'clock, I received notification from the UDA secretariat that the chairman had tested positive for COVID. We didn't know that he was in hospital since the 27th. The moment I heard that, I wouldn't say panic, but I called some doctor friends, including a very good friend from HUKM, and he said that given the circumstances, it's best that I should go get myself tested. I went to HUKM immediately, but I didn't realize they didn't have the test kit and so on. They would have to send me to HKL. And I spoke to another doctor friend who said that Sungai Buloh is the infectious disease center and I should go there. So at about 2:30 of Sunday, I went to Sungai Buloh and I found that there were quite a number of people there. The big guns of Kazana was there. And they were my friends. So we joked about it and said that let's have a reunion in Sungai Buloh. Now, I had my test, my swab taken at about 5:30 and then 6:30 they told me to go off. My wife, they checked her up, but they didn't take a swab. So they said go back and then wait for the result. The next day, which is the 2nd of March, which is a Monday, at about 5 or 6 o'clock, I received a call from the hospital to say that my test was positive and they would want me to come in. I was a bit surprised. I was a bit unhappy that the test is positive and I was concerned who would I have met during that period because I did some reading as well. If I display symptoms or my test is positive on the second, test being taken on the first, I would have to go back a few days. So the ambulance came and I told the hospital, I spoke to a very nice doctor, Dr. Salina and Dr. Haikal, and I told them that I would like them to bring my wife in as well. Although she did not have a swab taken, I wanted her swab taken. my wife is asthmatic, and I didn't want her to be alone at home in case, you know, things were to happen. So they made a concession. They allowed my wife to go into the same ambulance, and we went to Sungai Buloh. We got there about 9, 10 o'clock at night. My wife's room was not ready until about midnight, and I waited for her. We were separated because I was already positive. She wasn't sure. They weren't sure about her results. So there I went in, and I found three other people in my ward, which were all my colleagues in UDA. So being amongst familiar faces, I wasn't, we were all trying to cheer each other up. The next day, my wife's result came out that she was also positive. So the hospital said that I could be reunited with my wife, but her room was meant as a single room, so they just had to push me in into her ward. And I thought that was rather comical because they wouldn't let me get out of my bed. I was fairly strong and well, but they said, you need to sit in your bed and we push you around. I used to do that a lot with my grandchildren. So I thought that was rather funny. And I said my goodbyes to my three other colleagues. And there I was from the third onwards with my wife sharing the same room. So that's about what the timeline was.
You mentioned that you were unhappy when you first got the results. Can you tell us more about that? Was testing positive something that you had mentally prepared for?
I wouldn't say unhappy in that way, but there I was very concerned when I saw the doctor on the 25th and I saw the doctor on the 29th. Here I was reading a lot about all these things, but when I was told I was not displaying any symptoms, I was naturally a bit surprised, and I was a bit concerned that I may have met people during that period between the 24th to the 29th or the 1st. Had I suspected that I am a suspect PUI, they call it PUI, persons under investigation, I certainly would not have gone to office. I would not have done my normal business. Because I'm a fairly strong person and slight fever or slight doesn't really quite bother me. So that feeling was, if only our neighborhood clinics and so on are a bit more equipped or would take this a bit more seriously given the situation, then I may not have unknowingly infected the people whom I did.
Mm. Well, what was that process like with regards to informing and testing the people you had been in contact with? How soon did that happen after you got your results?
Right. In that sense, I was a bit more organized. I suppose being trained as a lawyer, we know, we read what we must do. And by the time I was back in the hospital, in fact, on the 1st of March, which was a Saturday, I already had a list of people whom I have been in contact with. But I only went back as far as the 24th because I suspected that that was my first contact point. So I had listed out the people whom I met on a particular day. So by the time I went in on the 2nd, they had a fairly good list of the people. But again, it helped that I was in the hospital because I was then not distracted and I could actually go through my phone photos and so on to see whom I met and so on. And from there, I prepared a fuller list, which I exchanged with Dr. Haikal. He's a very good doctor from Pejabat Kesihatan Daerah of Petaling. So we then mapped out who we would have met and so on, and we matched who should be interviewed or who should be contacted. So I think it is very important that if you suspect you are positive or you have been tested positive, to immediately prepare a log sheet. This is what we call the contact list of all the people who you may have been informed with. And therefore, I spend my time calling them up as well and to tell them, hey, look, I have been tested positive. I met you on a particular day. I think you should check up whether there are symptoms or no symptoms. So for me, what I did was I went back to the 24th. Now, later on when I met Dr. Haikal, he said that there are studies which showed that you need to go back longer than the period. So I went back 14 days and naturally the net became wider. But I can say this safely that from our combined investigation, no one prior to 24th of February were infected. So my children went for testing. My mates were sent for testing. So many people went for testing. I'm not sure if this will make the state government of Sarawak happy because I had a meeting with them on the 17th. And they all went for their test. I told Dr. Haikal and they contacted their counterpart in Sarawak. And they confirmed that everyone in Sarawak whom I met prior to the 14th and everyone else whom I met prior to the 24th were all cleared. So I think it is important that if you suspect you're such a person, to do that contact tracing. And it helps if you put your timeline and the people, including their phone numbers. That's what I did. It made the job easier for the Ministry of Health to be able to call up these people other than you themselves calling them up.
I was just about to ask how the process of contact tracing was shared between you and the Ministry of Health and what that looked like.
They are great. I can tell you this, and I have said this in some other interview that people asked me, and I said that we tend to look down or we tend to not appreciate our civil servants and medical services. From my own experience, they are very good. They are very methodical. Of course, if you do not cooperate, if you hide certain things, then you can't blame them for missing up certain points. In my case, I had used my phone call logs and my phone photos to track the timelines of whom we met. Because in our moments of trying to get information, sometimes we tend to forget certain things. And those that I missed out during the time that I was in the first few days of the hospital, I went through it again to clarify and verify that I did not miss anyone who would be of such importance. Quite a number of my friends who came into contact with me, for example, on the 28th, 29th, they were clear. I don't know whether what is it in their genes, and we made jokes about it. I said, Malayalis and Punjabis probably are strong because these are my Malayali and Punjabi friends. Then there was, of course, a good friend, a Chinese friend, who insisted to shake hands with me after not seeing me for quite a while. And I told him, look, I was having the flu. This was before I knew that I was infected. And he went for his test and he was clear. So I don't really know what exactly it is. But the first thing to do would be to see if you have symptoms.
Rosli, let's pick back up at that point in Sungai Buloh Hospital when you were first admitted with your wife, who had also tested positive. What was that like?
You see, between me, my wife and I have always been the stronger person. And she was asthmatic. So naturally, in her first 2-3 days, the doctors did their x-ray and they were not happy with the result. So it could probably be both her bronchitis and her asthma affecting what the doctors were afraid of, pneumonia. Yeah. So the doctor said not to move around, not even to go so much into the toilet. I'm supposed to observe if she gets breathlessness when she goes into the toilet. So naturally, my wife, I feel much more comforted to have her in front of me so that I can actually observe her. On my part, I am an active person. Imagine being confined to a room of, say, 16 feet by 16 feet, and all there is to escape is to run to the toilet. So I spend the next few days having a routine of cleaning up, mopping the floors and so on, and doing those things. I think it's great to do cleaning up.
So, were you able to observe how the other infected patients were feeling?
On the first night I was with the other people, I think everyone was rather somber and quiet. But as I said, I was moved out to be with my wife on the second day, and therefore I didn't know how they are. But we do have a chat group, and I formed a chat group not only with my UDA people, but with other people whom I knew were already in hospital, some by me, mostly not. I felt that rather than to be sad about it, we should all try to motivate each other. So there were a lot of bantering, there were a lot of motivational experiences, you know. And I think that's important, especially now the whole of Malaysia is in a lockdown situation. We shouldn't make it sound so terrible. If I can find things to do in the hospital, we are now all in our homes under the RMO. There are a lot more things that we can do. You can do your gardening. You can do whatever that you want. Make yourself useful so that the time is not wasted. But you can also do a lot of work. Today, we can communicate a lot with the smartphone, with the notebook, and so on.
Having said that, how did the infection impede on what you were able to do while you were in the hospital?
Yeah, you know, I just started a new firm on the 20th of February 2020. And then the 24th, I met someone. And then by the 1st, I had to be in hospital. So naturally, that created a bit of a chaos to my firm. And a lot of the things that I need to do as a principal partner of the firm could not be done. So that impacted the young firm very badly. And can you just imagine, at that stage, I had to tell clients, and but that was fairly early because Malaysia, by then, I was just only a patient number 30-something and so on. And something new, people were afraid. Suddenly, a lot of rumors were floating around, you know, almost turning me into the proverbial leper that should be cast away. And I think that was the most painful thing for me. Until now, when I think about it, I do sort of a sense of, I become a bit emotional about it. But I tell myself, well, people do not know. People are fearful of what they do not know. And I shouldn't hold it against people who are fearful because of ignorance.
That's quite unfortunate. Did you feel that other people treated you differently when they found out that you had tested positive?
It wasn't just about what I feel, because I saw various emails floating around, and some were so insensitive as to name me. I had rival firms that sent out notices to their own people, purportedly on the basis of trying to take preventive measures, but I wasn't sure whether they were breaching the medical laws in saying and identifying me openly. And some of these emails, in as much as they were supposed to be an internal email, it went out and it went viral amongst at least the legal community. So by the 3rd or the 4th or the 5th, I was already known as the lawyer who got infected with COVID-19. And it's almost like a death warrant to my new firm. You know, I would never wish it on anyone. I would never wish it even on my worst enemy. But there it was. Suddenly, my firm became a pariah. I became a leper.
Do you think there was anything you could have done at that point?
The only thing I could do then was actually to confide and talk to the two doctors, Dr. Haikal and Dr. Yasmin. And they told me that those people are not supposed to do that. In fact, you are supposed to keep the patient identity confidential. But I saw emails floating around to say the Ministry of Health had informed us that so-and-so has tested positive. And I asked them, I mean, did the ministry approve of that? And they said no. And some friends suggested that I should complain to MCMC or the police or whatever and so on. After sitting down, thinking about it, doing my prayers, I felt that I should forgive those who did that, even if they did that maliciously. A bit of understanding would help them. And in some of these cases, I'm sorry, I'm feeling a bit emotional about this, yeah? I felt that if things were to reverse and they were to have the same thing, how would they react and how would I react? And, you know, God is great. Some of their people tested positive, not through me. And it was a test on my own faith whether I would be joyous, and I wasn't. I was sad. I wish that it would not happen to anyone. In one or two instances, I actually wrote to these people by email and say, I'm very sorry to hear your people are infected. Please do not do any finger pointing. This is a time for us to come together. This is a time for us to show support. And imagine I'm saying this from my own hospital room. I won't say hospital bed because I wasn't really lying down most of the time. And I feel that it's those kind of messages that would help. Now, Then on the 18th of March, we have the government announcing a clampdown, this lockdown. And I said, now everyone can see what it is. I wouldn't want people to go through this inconvenience or suffering, but at least now there will be no more finger pointing. Of course, I have to also say this, that I was not happy when I read about the Tabligh Jamaati, and I felt that all religious groups must be responsible and not behave in a manner in the name of faith or piety, we become foolish. And I've said this to friends, that for Muslims, we must learn from history. There is a very famous incident called the Plague of Amwas. And in this plague, quite a number of the Prophet's companions died. And if you're going to believe in supernatural things and so on, and you're going to believe in piety will save you and so on, then the companions of the Prophets are the best of people who should have been perfected. But when a plague comes on you, it is both a situational thing, but also for us to strengthen our faith and not blame anyone, but to seek solace in God. And that's what I think being responsible about it is, not to infect others knowingly. And when I say knowingly, by congregating and so on and so forth. And it's good that we have a new minister in charge of religion, the former Mufti of Wilaya, whose knowledge is beyond reproach, and people will understand and appreciate what he says, rather than, you know, this false belief that faith alone will cure you.
And you talked about how wonderful the medical attention you received while in Sungai Buloh. Could you tell us more about that?
When I say wonderful, it is more about how they treat us. You just imagine, every time they wanted to come into my room, they will have to put on their hazmat suit, which means they are covered from top to toe. And they take it off after leaving my room and going into another room. So if you look at how the patients, I use the word, they treated us with patience and compassion, I think that compassion part is what that struck me and touched me most. And I hear the same story being told by other patients in Sungai Buloh, HKL, or even Seremban. They told me that these people are very patient, and I respect it. And that is why I feel that we should acknowledge what I call the unsung heroes of the battle against COVID in Malaysia. On the treatment itself, if you have a precondition like my wife, they will give you antiviral tablets and what other medicine to make you more comfortable. For me, I didn't have a precondition, so my treatment was minimal. Other than the days when I say that I had a fever, they would give me fever medicine, Panadol. Other than that, I wasn't given much of a medicine. I was told that that's part of the knee, basically to isolate me and for my own body to develop antibody to fight the virus. And by the 10th day, I was already cleared. But my wife was not, because by then there were cases of the Jamaat Tabligh, which had swarmed the labs. So I had to stay longer in order to wait for my wife's clearance, because they had to send that up to the IMR. So from a treatment point, first, if you do observe symptom of cough and fever, please go for a checkup. The treatment itself that I received in Sungai Buloh was not from the medicine. I was given minimum medicine. What I meant by treatment is the very good treatment that I got from the doctors, the consultants, the nurses, and the medical assistants. That's why I feel very touched by them. Every time they come and see us, technically they are exposing themselves. And this is something that we should truly appreciate our medical caregivers.
That really is heartwarming. Was there ever any concern from the doctors that you might become reinfected, though? Because at that point, as you mentioned, your wife had not yet recovered, whereas you had.
Well, according to the doctor, once I have the antibody, I should be okay. But there were concerns because the medical reports were still coming in. I may have taken it a bit, I wouldn't say lightly, but there was some concern because some of those people who had gone in, I will not mention them, they tested negative earlier, but they had persistent fever. And then only on the seventh day, then One of them was tested positive and subsequently went into ICU. The same thing happened with patient number 26. He went into ICU. So all of us, all we could do was pray for him in whatever mode and in manner of faith. And it was a very exhilarating feeling when patient 26 suddenly texted back after 4 days or 5 days of silence. He says that, "I'm back from the death zone." You know, we didn't know how to react because in the chat group, like, oh my God, he was quiet for 5 days. And suddenly he's saying, "I'm back from the death zone." That's his exact words in his WhatsApp. And all of us in echoes and in chorus saying, "Alhamdulillah," you know, the non-Muslims were saying, "Praise be to the Lord," and so on. And that's what I meant when I say people of all faith will come together. And this is the best of our human decency. We pray for the well-being of our brothers and sisters who are not well.
This was something we on the outside had heard as well, that patient number 26 was in the ICU in critical condition. There was, I guess, a lack of clarity. What was it like being in Sungai Buloh while all of that was unfolding?
Well, I did not want to leak out any of this private conversation or chat group because I knew that if we were to say, "Hey, so-and-so is in ICU, critical, and this and that," the story would become amplified, you know? Now, in my case, when one of our board members went into ICU, I had the fortune of speaking to the doctor. And I said, "Doc, I know you can't disclose this, but can you please explain how worrisome it is?" And actually, the doctor said this. In the second week, they expect some of the patients to go down. So they could either wait for it or they preempt it. So in the case of that particular patient, the doctors preempted it by putting him into ICU earlier. So when I saw WhatsApp floating around and viral messages going around that person was very sickly, I tried to calm the situation by telling, "Look, actually it was a preemptive move by the doctors and the consultants." And I think that was a very smart move. And we shouldn't spread that story that he's in ICU because that would create panic. And true enough, 4 days or 5 days later, the patient came out and said, "Hi guys, I'm back from the death zone." We were stupefied on how to respond, but the chorus of saying, you know, "Praise be to the Lord, thank goodness, Alhamdulillah," and so on, I think that helped a lot. And I believe those messages also filtered down to the rest. And I'm glad that no one in Sungai Buloh leaked about that person being, you know, in a frightening condition. Of course, when I heard that, I was a bit concerned about my wife because she is asthmatic and that person is asthmatic. But thank goodness, I hope being around her and making prayers for her helped a lot. And even if it didn't, I think having calmness in faith will help you in going through a testing moment, especially when you hear someone is terribly unwell.
What were the conversations like between you and your family during this time? I imagine there would have been concern and perhaps some anxiety.
I think I'm grateful to my wife because she's raised my children to be fairly well-informed, well-educated. So we were in communication. We didn't even tell my other bigger family because my other bigger family is the typical big Malaysian family who would, you know, properly dramatize certain things. Of course, my sisters were very upset when they subsequently discovered that I kept it a secret. But as far as my immediate family, that means my children, the first thing they did was to go for a test to ensure that they were not moving around with the virus and they were cleared. My grandchildren, I have two. I chat with them daily. That gave a source of happiness for me. I could see that they were well. My mates and immediately the PKD arranged for the medical team to come down to my house and check them, and they were all right. So as far as my immediate family was concerned, my children were very supportive. And I joked with them, "At least now I know I can depend on you guys if I were to go old." They followed the rules strictly. They came to the hospital wearing masks. They brought our favorite food, not that we can't order from Grab. So these are some of the comforts of life that, not the physical thing, not the tangible thing. Of course, bringing extra pillows, prunes and the nicer things in life help. But it's the feeling that people care for you. And that's what I wanted to convey, that the patients should appreciate all the medical caregivers. And the medical caregivers should know that. And the patients doing that would then, everyone around will feel better. Now we are in a situation of lockdown. If you all care for each other, even if it's just a question of asking, hey bro, how are you this morning? It helps a lot to know that people care. And I think Malaysians generally do care.
So tell us then what it was like when the day arrived for you and your wife to be discharged.
You know, even when I was in the hospital, I was texting the three doctors I mentioned to you, Dr. Salina, Dr. Haikal, and Dr. Yasmin, telling them that when I'm discharged and when things are calmed down, I would like to give them a big treat. And I would, and these doctors were saying, yeah, thank you, you know. But, let's think about how you're going to recover first. And it is very touching because you know they care for you, and you know that whatever you say about wanting to reward them or any, at least on their mind, but it made them feel appreciated. Yeah. As to leaving Sungai Buloh, I must say this, I have a wonderful neighborhood of Tropicana Indah 315. When they discovered that my wife and I were in Sungai Buloh, they were very supportive. Everyone gave very good motivational messages. And there was no finger pointing. It was just about getting well and so on. And when I got out, I was very touched. I walked into the house. There were flowers in the house from neighbors who thought that I had already been discharged earlier. And it's a strange feeling of feeling happy leaving Sungai Buloh, but at the same time, sad for those who are still there. And yet wanting to be able to tell them, look, it's a question of time, because it is a question of time. Once you ride over the 10 days, 14-day period, you will have the antibody and you would be okay. And that's how I motivated some of them. I said that according to the studies, according to the doctors, we will now be okay. And if we expect Malaysia to, you know, be a bit more difficult in the next 2-3 months, we are fortunate that we've got it earlier and therefore we shouldn't be getting it again, theoretically.
Yeah. And on that note, have you and your wife been healthy? Have you been keeping well? You mentioned earlier that you're going for 2 km swims, so that sounds promising.
As I said, my wife is enjoying. She's living like a Tai Tai, you know. For me, it's a bit different from my normal routine. I'm an early riser. I'm normally out in the hills hiking and so on when I'm not working. I can't do that. I get up early for my morning prayers at about 6 o'clock. And then I wait until the sun comes out to get some good sun. And people all believe that the virus is killed by hot temperature. And I try to do my swimming in the morning and the evening. More to test whether there is an impact, because the doctors warned us to that there might be breathlessness and so on. So I wanted to see whether by doing, you know, a 1 or 2 km lap, I would suffer such breathlessness. Thank goodness I haven't. I don't see, this is already my 4th day or 5th day at home. I'm living my normal life, except that I'm, you know, confined to my house. Once the RMO is over, I hope to go to the hills and show that I think life goes back normal.
Right. Well, and until then, I think a lot of people are still feeling a bit shaken by what's happening, especially if they're worried about being carriers themselves or being exposed to carriers. What advice would you have for them?
I think the first advice is we have the government already issuing the RMO, Restricted Movement Order. We must obey it. Yeah? There are enough illustrations and graphics about this one, which is very good, about a domino of matchstick. All you need to do is one person to step out and you stop the fire. So I think what the government is doing is following what the Chinese have done, and that is to avoid crowded places so that there is lesser social contact, and by it, if you are having virus, but it's not coming up symptomatically as a fever and so on, after 14 days, that virus would die itself or your body would have some antibody. So I think from that aspect, the government is doing its part. We need to do our part. We are not under curfew. We can go out, wear masks, you know, and do it only necessarily. We shouldn't be going out socializing or having teh tarik and so on. I think it's only a 14-day period. I think we should obey those orders, including even for religious groups. Muslims are supposed to do congregational prayers 5 times a day and Friday once a week. This is a question of priority. All religions will tell you that the preservation of life is a greater priority than what you think is your faith of congregational prayers. And I gave an example that the two deaths that we experience is one is a Jamaat Tabligh, the other one is a pastor, one a Christian, the other one a Muslim. When COVID hits, and in fact, it does not make a distinction of whether you are a Christian or a Muslim, or you're no religion, or you're an atheist. So we must be responsible and avoid being another contact point that can spread the virus.
Yeah, I think something for all of us to remember there. Finally, Rosli, if you were to share a message of hope for Malaysians, what would it be?
Malaysians should not be depressed over this. Neither am I saying rejoice and so on, no, but the 14-day period can be used fruitfully. There's some naughty ones who can then, you know, have your Netflix for the next 14 days. We shouldn't panic. The government has assured there is no food shortages. My neighbors sent me photographs of giant fully stocked and so on. So what you saw earlier of people showing empty shelves is because there is a sudden surge. There's a sudden panic. If there's no panic, there is no shortage. And in our country, we see that all the time during festival season. During Chinese New Year, people will think that there's a shortage of certain items and it, you know, becomes empty. But if we do not behave in a panicky situation, we behave calmly, we support each other, I think we will come out of this as well as how the Chinese have been. And I read the report saying that Wuhan will be officially declared open on the 21st, which is just on Saturday. So Malaysian, it's only 14 days. You can still work from home. You can do so many things. So let's not be depressed about it.
Rosli, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us today. You just heard from Rosli Dahlan, who was recently discharged from Sungai Buloh Hospital after being successfully treated for COVID-19. If you have any thoughts, you can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.